Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Progressive Britain podcast. I'm Joel Holland. In this episode, I speak to Lord Peter Hayne, author of numerous books, including two of his most recent, which we build this discussion around, A Rhino Conspiracy, released this summer in paperback, and his autobiography, A Pretoria Boy. Peter grew up in South Africa under apartheid rule before moving to the UK with his family. We discuss how both of his books focused on the historical and recent corruption in South African politics, and some of the more incredible parts of his personal journey.
So, Peter, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
It's great to be with you, Joe, and to support your Progressive Britain initiative.
I really, really enjoyed reading both your books. Thoroughly enjoyed the kind of crash course in South African history that I've given myself over the past kind of couple of weeks. I wasn't terribly well versed in it, but such a fascinating recent history. I want to start asking you about the Rhino Conspiracy. What was it that initially motivated you to write a book about rhino poaching? Because you invoked, as you explained in Pretoria Boy, you invoked parliamentary privilege to talk about the legal diamond trade, amongst other things, but never for rhino horn smuggling. So was the initial plan to write an allegory of the corruption of the past decade, and you saw rhino smuggling as a good conduit for that story? Or was the initial motivation to write a novel about rhinos? Was it the safari and the action, the rhinos, the poaching itself that motivated you to write it?
It was a bit of all of that. After I stepped down as an MP, after Ed Miliband, the year before, in 2014, that is, had surprisingly asked me out of the blue to go to the House of Lords. My reaction was, I don't agree with the place. I think it should be reformed. To which he replied, that's why I'd like you to go there. Anyway, I stepped down as an MP at the 2015 election after I'd represented Neath for a quarter of a century. And Elizabeth, my wife, and I went for a safari on holiday that August, September, in a wonderful wildlife park called Tula Tula in KwaZulu-Natal. And it was seeing rhinos chomping away peacefully in the bush and realizing that they were under 24/7 security guarding. And seeing it there and kept that image and experiencing it, and obviously I knew broadly about rhino poaching, but made me think much more deeply about it. And then finding out from the rangers about the extent of the problem, and at the same time becoming much more aware, visiting South Africa more often than I'd been able to do when I was a member of parliament, because you know the job is 24/7. I had more time, and in the House of Lords I had more time, and I found myself going back more and then teaching there. And it was the two, and becoming much more aware of the corruption and the extent of the betrayal of the freedom struggle led so wonderfully by Nelson Mandela and internationally by Oliver Tambo, that my parents had taken part in as activists in South Africa, very brave that they were. And also I had, and a feeling of real gut-wrenching betrayal at the shameless corruption and cronyism that former President Zuma presided over with his colleagues, the Gupta brothers, his cronies, business cronies, and the plundering of taxpayer resources and the extent to which public utilities like the electricity supply and power company Eskom and the South African Airways, all nationalized industries, had become dysfunctional and bankrupt because of this corruption. It was the thought that I could then bring the two together, because the more I researched about rhino poaching, the more I realized that there were international criminal syndicates equivalent to drug traffickers and terrorists and really serious organized crime behind poaching, whether it's rhinos or elephants, and often corrupt politicians protecting them, whether in Africa or East Asia. So, by the way, I mentioned East Asia because that's where the consumer demand is. So I thought, well, maybe I could try my hand at writing a thriller that brought these two themes together, because they were from real life. And as somebody who reads thrillers when I get spare time, which isn't very often, I thought I'd try it. And that's how the Rhino Conspiracy was born.
Some of the characters, like the president, very clear who the president is supposed to be. The inspiration for some of the characters clearly comes from your life and from recent South African history. For example, the white woman who offers food and kindness to the future Supreme Court judge. And then after reading a Pretoria Boy, realized that was predicated on your mum.
That's right, yes.
But are there other characters who might not be obvious to people who don't know that much about South African history? And I'm thinking in particular of Moses Khoza. Correct me if I say these names wrong, please. But Moses Khoza, the corrupt but kind of self-aware official, very close to the president. And van der Merwe, how do you say his last name?
It was Moses Khoza and van der Merwe, actually. Piet van der Merwe, yeah.
Van der Merwe, okay, that's a tough one to name. Who engaged in the smuggling with him. So those two, I'm really interested to see where you came up with those characters, and also the two main younger characters, the lovers.
Yeah, well, let's start with Moses Khoza. I took some of his character from a real figure, a real ANC hero. But that ANC hero, so it's not fair to mention his name, though it's part of his biography, from the Soweto uprising in 1976. He was a real figure there, and he went to Robben Island. So that part of it is biographical, based on a real struggle hero. But then Khoza going bad as the president, who's fictional character, but it's not difficult to guess who he might be based on. His security chief is Khoza. And it's in that role and the kind of transformation from freedom struggle hero to corrupt security chief. His whole lifestyle and his family dependent on his self-enrichment through, in this case, the smuggling and the rhino poaching. It was a kind of almost a parable in itself of the way that the ANC became corrupt. I hope at any rate you'll agree that the character of Khoza is not a kind of, you know, he's not a total villain. He is, as you describe him, a rather self-aware villain. And he's a bit conflicted, but in the end, you know, his material needs of the time triumph over what his original values were. In the case of van der Merwe, I think he's a pretty typecast figure of his era, who was involved in the shady sort of mercenary side of apartheid, and has just seamlessly moved into opportunities for similar activity around the corruption. He doesn't like the transformation. He didn't like Mandela becoming president. He doesn't. He sort of hates the idea of no longer being part of a privileged white elite in ruling the country. But at the same time, he's benefiting from it, because the corrupt rulers in under the president and Khoza are the ones who are giving him lots of money, so that he can continue his kind of quasi criminal or actual criminal activity. There are other figures in the Isaac Mkhize, the ranger, is based on a couple of rangers in safari parks, different safari parks that I met, and I've kind of amalgamated them and the sort of the experiences and the characters that I witnessed and engaged with. Tunde Majeka, her surname is based on a domestic worker and very close friend of our family in Pretoria in the early 1960s. And if you,
Think that possibly was true when reading.
Yeah, when you read the Pretoria Boy, you'll see that Eva Majeka, who in the Rhino conspiracy is the kind of fictional grandmother of Tunde, who's a born free, that's to say, born after 1994. After the transition from apartheid, when Mandela became president, for a while that label has become unfashionable. But for a while, that was the kind of generation that had never known apartheid. So she's, I think, for me, she's the heroine of the whole story, and a very strong character, and I hope you like her. I hope you kind of engage with her. She's a very feisty feminist and radical activist. Her character is molded out of a combination of people that I've worked with in my life in the anti-apartheid struggle, and also in Labour Party and radical politics and anti-racist politics. But she's also somebody who understands her history, and a lot of the younger generation don't. So you see in her that she's very different from her peers, her school friends, her generation, that are more interested in, you know, the things that kids are interested in rather than the history and the values that propel her. The veteran, who's her kind of mentor, is based on a real figure, and a friend of mine. Yeah, those familiar with South African politics recognise him instantly, and I usually don't say who he is, but everybody kind of knows. But he's based. So I used him, and I know him, and he's a very close friend, and I use a lot of his biographical background to provide the context for him, but then I kind of give him a role in this thriller, which is entirely fictional, but probably very typical of what he would have done in this situation.
Yeah, he's a fascinating character. In terms of Tunde, I was struck by initially the parallels of the way that you describe yourself in A Pretoria Boy, and being more political than your peers a lot of the time, or being very political within your peer group, but also by this George Orwell quote that always gets thrown around when you talk about South Africa, which is the George Orwell quote. I think it's George Orwell. He says everything is political, and in the novel she says that constantly. You have her saying that a lot, that yes, everything is political. Yes. So I just saw those parallels there.
Yeah, you're right, and of course in the developing relationship, love relationship with Mkhize the Ranger, you know, he doesn't think of himself as political at all. And of course, he's true. That's true of most people, isn't it, Joe? You and I are unusual animals. We're highly political. If you think of your classmates, how many of them are like you? Probably very few. And that was true for me. So in that sense, we're not that different, though my story is unusual for, you know, as a Labour Party member. And so Isaac Mkhize, the ranger, you know, he sees himself as he's a wildlife person. That's his love, that's his mission, that's his career. Whereas she, you know, is a political activist. And so they come from these two different worlds. And then they realize that actually these worlds are colliding and merging. And that's how they begin to get more self-aware about each other. And he becomes more political as he becomes educated by her.
I'm not going to give the story away for someone who hasn't read it, but I was pleased the way that they ended. I was getting worried at certain points in the novel that they wouldn't end I wanted them to.
Well, it was meant to, you know, it's meant to kind of hold you turning the pages to find out.
Well, that's exactly what it did. Turning to Pretoria Boy, you talk in the first 100 or so pages a lot about the stress of living under the eyes of apartheid security forces. And for example, when your parents are both separately banned and forced to only interact with one person at any given time. In Rhino Conspiracy, there's a constant threat for the veteran, the sniper, Major Yasmin and Tundi in particular, being constantly followed. How much of that threat from state security and the furtiveness that your characters in the Rhino Conspiracy felt, how much of that comes from your own experience living under the apartheid regime with your parents representing the Liberal Party, particularly when the ANC get banned and then the Liberal Party is kind of the real focus for the apartheid government and security forces at that point? How much of those things are, you know, how much of your what you wrote in the Rhino Conspiracy has come from that experience?
I think a fair amount of it, but also I became much more aware before I started writing the Rhino Conspiracy and then during it, as I explained, I was visiting South Africa more and more, sort of four or five times a year, some in some cases around 2016, 2017, 2018. I was teaching at the university in Johannesburg, at Wits University, and now I've switched to teaching at Pretoria University. And I realized the extent to which, under former President Zuma, the state security apparatus had been turned. It had originally, under apartheid, been a political security machine, not to catch criminals, but to defeat and suppress the political opposition. That's what the police and the security services were about under apartheid. Mandela cleaned all that up and established a set of intelligence services and a security apparatus, including the police, was designed to uphold the rule of law and treat people, you know, and catch the real criminals and terrorists, not political opponents of the government. But Zuma then actually reproduced in his new security empire, which became his personal fiefdom, many features of the old apartheid state. And it became both a mechanism for extending corruption, but also a force for targeting his political opponents, both within the ANC and elsewhere. So I became very aware that actually, you know, like I described at the beginning of the Pretoria Boy, when I was asked to expose the international dimension to the corruption and cronyism, hence, you know, the use of parliamentary privilege in the House of Lords to do so. When everybody asked me to talk, we all switched our mobile phones off, and it was explained to me just how they were under surveillance. It reminded me of my Pretoria boyhood. So this was, you know, 2017, for goodness sake. So this is well into South Africa's new democracy. And here you find brave ANC activists resisting the Zuma corruption and criminality, actually under surveillance and being targeted by the security forces themselves. And, you know, as I was in their orbit, potentially I could have been as well. So I try to capture that, and it does, I think, accurately, and people who've read it, who've been in this world, in the modern era of resistance against corruption and criminality, say that it actually captures exactly what happened and what was happening at that time. And you know, it's still remnants of it that President Ramaphosa is trying to kind of root out.
It's really interesting to see the reflection of the way that they both, the surveillance under apartheid and then under former President Zuma, and the way that the parallels between them, but so separated in time and separated by Nelson Mandela's presidency, which...
And ideology, you know. Yeah, and here, you know, Zuma, of course, spent 10 years on Robben Island himself. You know, he was involved in the struggle. You know, he had a far from unblemished record, and the evidence is that he was already, you know, taking kickbacks and doing and putting stuff in his back pocket himself, even while he was in the push for the ANC in Africa and so on. But, you know, Zuma himself played an important role in the struggle, and yet he's ended up the way he did, like Robert Mugabe did. You know, there's a something that I think all of us involved in that period need to understand better why it's happened, because it isn't just South Africa. It is also Nicaragua, for example. You know, Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas were heroic figures in the 70s and the 80s for those of us in the anti-apartheid struggle and in the Labour Party. If you look back at that period, well, it, you know, the Sandinistas and under Ortega have been completely corrupt and dictatorial and authoritarian, and he himself has betrayed all of those values. So it isn't only South Africa where this happened.
Your parents seem like incredibly brave people, and you clearly fit the mold. Speaking at John Harris' funeral when you were 16, was it? 15 or 16?
15, yeah.
Going through the trauma of knowing what had happened to him, then receiving a letter bomb in England, being targeted by the British security forces, the South African state, being brought to court twice on ludicrous charges, you know, not to mention leaving your home country because your father's been blocked from working. Is it only when you look back at these events and moments that you realise how special of a story it is and how much happened to you before you turned 30? What impact did your parents have on you being able to deal with all this stuff that hit you so early?
Well, first of all, I've always admired them. Some children of anti-apartheid activists in that era resented what happened to them and their parents' activism, because it was a tough time. You know, families were uprooted like ours, and a lot suffered even more than we did. We never saw ourselves as suffering. We saw ourselves as coping more than suffering. A lot were treated much worse than us, especially black families. And my parents, they displayed a selflessness and a commitment to a sense of values and duty, which was not in their interests as a family, and not in their self-interest at all. They lost everything, including the country that they were born in and loved, and felt they were turning their back on their comrades in the struggle. But, you know, I think of a close friend of mine, I think I mentioned this in The Pretoria Boy, who, of my age, much brighter than me, much better sports, much better at sport than I was, and who committed suicide a year after coming into exile. So this is a tough business. I obviously, this is very formative for me in every sense. It's informative in the way that I've been a Labour MP, a government minister, and all the things I've been fortunate enough to do within the Labour Party. And I regard myself as privileged to have been a representative, and in a way still a representative. I mean, these are special positions that don't fall to many of us as Labour Party members. And, you know, for anybody who thinks they are special in getting these positions, no, you're lucky and you're privileged. But it has been formative, Joe, because that's the way I see the world. I don't see the class system as somebody born into it, like somebody like you is, consciously or unconsciously. Somebody born in Britain is born into a class system that is still alive and well. Not as harsh as it once was, but it's still very much alive. So I don't see it in that way. So that's my kind of attitude. Also, I think two other things I'd pick up. One, an impatience with high-flying rhetoric and grandstanding, and a desire simply to just get things done. Because in you know, anti-apartheid politics, particularly in my childhood, was literally black and white in every sense. But it was also life and death in lots of ways. So it was kind of in vivid technicolor rather than a lot of British politics, which has its own dramas, but these are, as it were, in much more grey and granular, much greyer and granular in terms of the sharpness of the issues. I mean, I care passionately about the lack of equality in Britain and the extent of poverty and the stunting of ambition and opportunity and a lot of other things. I'm passionately opposed to Brexit and an unapologetic Ramona. I think it's been disastrous. So I do feel passionately about British politics, but I think when you have been through a kind of life and death politics and experienced that as a child, and then, you know, subsequently being a foot soldier in the anti-apartheid movement, you see politics in a slightly different way. And some of the things that people get upset about, some of the personality clashes and the jockeying for position and all of that that goes on in the Labour Party, I've had very little time for. And always been impatient over. So I suppose it's affected me in that way, and of course a lot of others as well, including an uncompromising commitment to anti-racism and in all its forms.
The British security apparatus, being MI5 in particular, at that time, kind of trying to bring you down, or trying to bring the Liberal Party down, trying to bring the Labour Party down. I mean, to me, that seems, well, I mean, that must have been such a difficult thing to deal with, an entire state security apparatus you knew were on your back. I mean, what was that like?
Well, that period in the mid-1970s, which I tried to kind of explain, I hope convincingly, in that chapter around the bank theft and why it happened, when I ended up being charged with a bank theft I didn't even know had occurred. I knew nothing about it when I was arrested.
It's a crazy story, that, really.
It is. It's surreal. It's, anybody who's read Franz Kafka's The Trial.
Really Kafkaesque, yeah.
It certainly was. And in some ways, you know, it's hard to believe it ever happened, but it certainly did. And there were factions inside MI5 in particular, and I've documented this, and been written about by former MI5 and intelligence officers that were involved in a big right-wing plot to destabilize the Labour government of that period and to get a right-wing conservative government. So that was a political use of the intelligence services. It is much more difficult to imagine that happening now, because partly of reforms that we introduced as a Labour government and the greater transparency and accountability that there is for all in, you know, the three main intelligence services, MI5, MI6, and GCHQ. But at that time, you know, yes, I was targeted. There was an MI5 file. There was an MI5 file on me, as the head of MI5, Stephen Lander, came to tell me when I was a Labour minister in the Foreign Office. And the special branch, as I discovered, I knew at the time, were tapping my phone and in the late 60s and the 70s and following me around. And when the undercover policing officer's inquiry was established, and I gave evidence to it earlier this year, into undercover policing and the scandals around it that have been revealed in recent years, and when I was shown all the documentation from Special Metropolitan Police Special Branch files, it turns out there was, and I was shown it in, you know, the rules of the inquiry, or you get shown a lot of stuff, but you can't openly talk about it in specific terms. You sign that kind of agreement of confidentiality. But obviously you can talk about it in general terms. And it turns out that since the late 60s, going right the way through to when I was an MP in the early 90s, there was an undercover police officer in almost every meeting that I was at. Some of them completely trivial and non-consequential meetings about old age pensioners, meetings about the environment and so on. And the question I asked when I gave my evidence, and I say this in the Pretoria Boy, is that actually our intelligence services in that era were on the wrong side of history. They were effectively, they were targeting anti-apartheid activists like me and many others, and anti-racist activists, including, you know, the family of Stephen Lawrence, Labour peer Doreen Lawrence, his mother. They were infiltrating. This is recently. Police were covering that up. So I don't think we should be complacent that these things are consigned to history. But, you know, for somebody of your generation, reading about what happened to our Labour government, let alone what happened to me as an anti-apartheid activist, or when I was active as a radical young liberal before I joined the Labour Party in 1977. Yeah, I mean, it's important people know that history, because it has great salience, and it's, you know, the thing I think so important for all Labour Party members, and particularly young members, you know, is not to become bookish and engrossed in only reading our history, but to understand it, because it is important. It is important to know that we came from struggles for trade union rights and votes for women and votes for working men, and to extend trade union and workers' rights as well. It's important that, you know, we understand that history rather than see the Labour Party as just something that's landed in our current era.
Of course, and a big part of that history is sport, and a big part of the furor and the attention around and towards you was because of what you were doing when it came to cricket and rugby and disrupting these tours. And you talk about how later in the 70s and 80s, you were pragmatic when it was brought to your attention that potentially you could mitigate segregation within sport, not necessarily have it impact South African society in general, but that you thought it was a good idea to have an impact on sport if you could at that point. Is that something that you started off with in 1969 when you started dictating this protest against the sport? Was that something you saw as the end goal, or was it initially just something that you thought you had to do something, you had to do anything to combat this apartheid government?
Well, remember that sport under apartheid was uniquely organized for sport across the world, in that you couldn't play for your country if you didn't have a white skin. So that, for example, Basil de Oliveira, the top South African cricket star, who happened to be of mixed blood parentage, in other words, designated a coloured South African under apartheid, could not play for the top clubs, the top provincial sides, or his own national side, because the apartheid laws barred that, and had to come to England, and ended up being a top England cricketer from 1966, when I came to Britain as a 16-year-old as a cricket fan, and saw him play for England. So sport was in a very different, you know, sport under apartheid was unique. There's been nothing like it ever since, or only to some extent before under the Nazis in their treatment of the Jews. And the comparison, in another book I've recently co-written with my friend André Udendahl called Pitch Battles, I wrote the section on sport and Nazism and the Berlin Olympics of 1936, and the language used by Nazi leaders, the policies they implemented to exclude Jewish German citizens from the opportunity to use local gyms or to take advantage of their sporting excellence to rise up the ladder to represent their country in the Olympic team, which was barred by the Nazis. So that was the only parallel. And why I targeted sport as a 19-year-old and found myself leading a campaign, never imagining that I'd lead a mass national campaign to target the 1969-70 Springbok tour, was partly because I was passionate about sport. Most young white South African boys are and were, certainly of my generation. And I was passionate about the anti-apartheid cause and saw the opportunity to really make a big difference, which is, you know, has been my watchword all through my political career, spanning over half a century, to focus on where you can really make a difference. to try for the bigger goals. Of course, I was in favor of economic sanctions, campaigned for those, in favor of an arms embargo, campaigned for that. But we could physically, by running on the pitch at Twickenham or Lord's Cricket Ground, we could physically stop white South African, whites only South African teams, because they were never South African, they were only white South African, from playing. And we did. And we disrupted through non-violent direct action the Springboks tour of 1969-70. I was arrested quite a few times and carried out of the ground and dumped outside, having tried to get on the pitch. And then we stopped the cricket tour of 1970, which was always the objective of the Stop the 70 tour campaign that I helped conceive and ended up leading. And that had a seismic impact because, you know, South Africa was used to being shunned in the United Nations and looked down upon. And, you know, Britain's prime ministers of whatever political color said they were all opposed to apartheid. But we continued to trade with South Africa. We continued to arm South Africa, except for a period under Labour when we banned arms sales that the Tories promptly repealed when they got into power in 1970. And resumed them. So I was in, you know, white South Africa was used to being, everybody said how distasteful they found apartheid, but actually they continued to trade and arm and have sporting contact. And for the Springboks, and you know, to come and be feted, because they were the best team in the world at this time, be feted as the mighty Springboks, at, you know, given lavish hospitality, and then there were tours over there in the sunshine. It was a big deal for them when suddenly these tours were stopped. And if you talk, you know, as I did to Nelson Mandela afterwards, he said how important it was, that campaign. If you talk to white South Africans today, they will tell you many of them still hate me. And the ones who don't will say it had an incredible impact. So, you know, in the end, yeah, I was a small part of that history of ultimate victory by the anti-apartheid movement.
Well, very interestingly, at one point in Pretoria, boy, you talk about how you were in Lord's Cricket Ground after apartheid ended, and there was still some people in the VIP section in the box who were muttering about you and who still hated you from 30 years prior. What do you see in the current take-a-knee protests over the kind of the last 18 months or so? Because that's obviously a protest against racism in sport. And it's really, I mean, in my lifetime, it's the biggest use of sport as a vehicle for protest that I've ever seen. So how do you feel when you see players taking the knee as regularly as you
I strongly support it and really observe with great admiration the stance taken by players like sports stars like Lewis Hamilton, who's a friend, so I'm a Formula One fan, and Raheem Sterling, who plays for the wrong team because I'm a Chelsea fan, but Raheem Sterling's been very brave. So has Marcus Rashford, Megan Rapinoe, the US football captain, speaking out strongly for women's rights in sport and for equality generally. You know, it's only a few years since Colin Kaepernick, who was the first one to take the knee as an American football star. He was sacked effectively. And you go back to Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who in the 1968 Olympics at Mexico, they were gold and silver medal winners. They raised their Black Power salute against racism in America, which was absolutely rampant then, even more so than it is now. And they were completely castigated, shunned, lost their jobs and all sorts of consequences. So to see sports stars taking the knee and standing up for themselves as black stars, like, you know, Lewis Hamilton or Raheem Sterling, and to see them getting traction and the blessing of the football establishment, the motor racing establishment, the sporting establishment generally, which has always turned its back on moral and social justice questions, and to some extent still does, I mean, that's been a big shift. Now, I'd only qualify that by saying that, you know, these are stars at the top of their sports. Lewis Hamilton didn't speak out, as he himself has openly acknowledged, until he was a 7 times world champion and probably the best Formula One driver the world has ever known. So he had a status and an unassailability that enabled him to give expression to his views. Raheem Sterling's an England international, you know, the Manchester City stars, one of the best teams in the world. And so they, in a way, they're a bit untouchable in the current climate. And that does show a progressive shift. But, you know, the fact that they still get booed for taking the knee by England's fans and by a lot of football fans in different stadia around the Premier League and in the lower leagues shows there's still a lot of grassroots racism and a big battle still to win.
Can we turn to Nelson Mandela? You mentioned speaking to him on multiple occasions. For someone who grew up in the 90s like me, he was, I mean, iconic is an understatement. You defend him in A Pretoria Boy from the rather niche criticism that he sold out by not completely restructuring the economy to take economic power totally out of the hands of the white elite. And you defend him from that charge under the reasoning that taking economic power totally out of the hands of the white elite would have caused mass capital flight from South Africa and destroyed the economy. But given what's happened to South Africa's economy over the past decade, at least partially due to, as you say in Pretoria Boy, the lingering inequality of ownership over the economy, do you still think it would have played out worse had the ANC decided in the 90s under Mandela to completely uproot the economic status quo at that point?
Well, first, those critics who accuse Nelson Mandela of being a sellout are relatively small. A group of radical intellectuals in the current era. And you know, first of all, I think their critique is ahistorical. When Mandela came to power and in the transition from a brutal apartheid state that, by the way, murdered more people, including his followers, in the period from when he walked to freedom from prison in February 1990 to when he became president a little over 4 years later in April 1994, more people were killed. So the old apartheid state was still trying to cling on to power, and there was a lot of third force activity and shadowy, shady murder squads and so on, effectively presided over by President F.W. de Klerk, who was nevertheless freed Mandela and was negotiating a transition. They were still trying to cling on to power. So, you know, they had all the fighting power. Yeah, the ANC had guerrilla forces and a certain military, paramilitary strength through its underground force MK in Kuntu Isizwe. But the truth is the army was under apartheid white control, the police were under apartheid white control, the security forces were, the economy was. So the ANC, there was the kind of stasis had been reached where the ANC had the power to wreck the economy and wreck the governability of the country and effectively trigger a civil war. It was on the brink of that. So, and the white minority had lost the ability to stop that and realized its more intelligent elements realized that there had to be change. So this is a very delicate time. And those that say that he was a sellout and that the transition was somehow a betrayal effectively are advocating a revolutionary course. Where you had a bloody civil war and then the ANC somehow won against this massive military and security might. And I think that would have been terrible. And I think the country would not have recovered from it, still wouldn't have done. And if you look at what happened to Angola, and I mentioned this and Mozambique in particular, two former Portuguese colonies, where there were pretty vicious guerrilla wars, vicious in the sense the Portuguese were ruthless in their killing power, and the guerrillas were pretty kind of ruthless as well. It was a serious civil war and a serious battle being fought to the end. And you had a society just destroyed by that, and took generations to recover. And Mozambique's still not fully. Angola, because of its vast resources, you know, is now economically strong, but still in an awful lot of problems, including corruption in the society. Well, I think South Africa's experience has been a better example. But, and by the way, if Mandela had instantly just expelled, somehow kind of nationalized every business in the country and took control, whatever that meant, in a kind of Leninist way, there would have been a massive flight of capital, a massive flight of skills, and the economy would have been bankrupted. So I don't think they had any alternative but to pursue the strategy that he did, with the backing of the entire ANC, by the way. However, as I also say, there has not been enough economic transformation. And it's difficult. You know, we find, and I say this as a Labour minister, we found that, you know, serving under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, bringing about economic change in a Labour Party direction, socialist direction, social democratic direction, whatever label you want to give it, is really hard. In terms of you're in under globalization, the neoliberal kind of hegemony that there is globally, it's really hard. You can't afford to lose market confidence. You can't afford to have withdrawal of foreign investment and all of that. So it's a big battle to bring economic transformation. And I think it should have been started earlier under Mandela and certainly under Mbeki. And if there's a criticism to be made of Mandela, it is that he didn't start that early enough. There was a process of black economic empowerment, but it resulted in the creation of a new black elite, a new black middle class, which is all to the good. But at least the middle class part of it's too good. Not you know, replacing a white elite with a black elite doesn't fundamentally alter the inequality in the society, which has actually got worse, as it has in all parts of the world, including Britain. And I put that down to neoliberalism as much as I do to the failure to transform. So I'm very kind of critical of that sellout accusation. I think it's ahistorical. I think it's politically juvenile. But I also think that there should have been a much more determined, you know, progressive year by year spreading of wealth and opportunity whilst growing the economy. You don't grow the economy, you can't do this.
And one thing that stopped any of that wealth distribution and simultaneously stopped the economy growing, and has taken this black idea of black economic empowerment and twisted it and into something unrecognizable, has been the influence of the Gupta brothers under former President Zuma. Given what's happened in recent weeks, where he's been released from jail and do the rest of his time outside of jail, it looks like. Do you see anything? Because you talk at the end of the Pretoria Board about the fact that the Gupta brothers need to be brought to justice, and if, you know, it would be good if they could face trial in South Africa at some point. But do you ever see that as realistically happening? And more importantly, you talk a lot in the Pretoria Boy about the international corporations, consultancies and banks that facilitated all this corruption over the past decade or so. And prior to that, what hope do you see of any of them changing the way that they're behaving and or being punished for their facilitation of this corruption?
Well, as I say towards the end of the book, and I gave evidence to the the commission chaired by Judge Deputy Chief Justice Zondo, looking into this whole era of President Zuma and the Gupta brothers' corruption stranglehold. It takes two to tango. And it wasn't just the corrupt politicians under President Zuma and his cronies, the Gupta brothers, but actually the corporations, the banks, the HSBCs, the Standard Chartered, the Bank of Baroda's, who all facilitated that money laundering, that massive billions of rand, hundreds of millions of pounds that were money laundered abroad through their digital pipelines into Dubai, through Dubai and Hong Kong in the main, but some through London. And then all the corporations, the KPMGs, the McKinseys, and so forth, that all owned up eventually to their complicity. You asked me, do I see any chance of the Gupta brothers being arrested and brought to trial in South Africa? Well, I hope so. We've now finally got the British government to impose sanctions on them, as the American government did a year ago. That was quite a battle that I pressed the Conservatives hard for. Unless you have determined international governmental cooperation and the active cooperation of the banks, the financial institutions, the lawyers who help set up all these shady shell companies that are conduits for money laundering, the estate agents who, you know, find properties for them to invest their ill-gotten gains in, the consultancies who, you know, kind of help design all of this, and the auditors who basically give soft audits to it. All of this went on. And, you know, when I exposed it in the House of Lords, something very interesting happened. While it was a story, all this corruption and cronyism under Zuma and the Gupta brothers was a South African story being exposed by brave investigative South African journalists, and there were, you know, a number who were incredibly brave. While it was a South African story, it was, you know, in a sense confined to that space. When I did what I did in the Lords, it appeared on the front page of the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and so on. And it became an international story, and that's when the head of McKinsey and the head of KPMG and the directors of HSBC and Standard Chartered, you know, all asked to see me in my House of Lords office, which I was happy to do, because suddenly their global reputations were being trashed because of what their South African arm had done. But it wasn't until that time that they felt the heat at all. And they, you know, in a sense, they've made all sorts of promises. I don't think much changed. I think if there were another President Zuma somewhere, whether South Africa or anywhere else, and the equivalent of the Gupta brothers, I suspect much the same would happen. There's $2 trillion a year money laundered, each and every year. I mean, that's much bigger than most economies in the world. Much, much bigger. And that's happening every year through all these household names being complicit in it. And, you know, a point I make in Pretoria, boy, is you and I want to open a bank account. We have to go through all sorts of hurdles to do so. You know, identity, proof of address, all these sorts of things. And you get checked up on them. I'm not questioning that. But then these international criminals like the Gupta brothers just get away with blue murder. So, you know, you're asking me, do I think there'll be change soon? Not until every president, every prime minister, every government of the world, and that means Beijing and Washington, it means Moscow and London, it means, you know, Berlin and Paris, and China is very important in this. Dubai, which is an ally of Britain's, through the United Arab Emirates, is very important in all this. They are all money laundering havens, frankly. And I don't think anything will change until there's global political leadership that's absolutely determined to root it out.
You said London. you mentioned briefly at the end of the book about the COVID procurement and the fact that the Tory party used companies run by their mates to supply stuff during the COVID pandemic. Is there any comparison between the corruption in the ANC and the corruption in the current Tory party?
I don't think there is really. The scale and the shamelessness of the corruption that is still plaguing the system, because it's like a cancer once it's in there. You know, it's very difficult to, once it's in the body, it's very difficult to root out. Once corruption has widely infested at every level of government, it's hard to root out. So I don't make any real comparison, but I don't think that, you know, British politicians should just look down their noses at what's been happening in South Africa and say, oh, well, nothing like that happens here. We have the MP's expenses scandal, you know, in a little over a decade ago, right at the heart of our politics. We had, you know, we had all these dodgy contracts being given out without proper tendering to friends of ministers of this Conservative government during COVID. And similar things have happened elsewhere in the world. So, you know, I think you have to keep a beady eye out for this sort of thing everywhere.
Do you have time for one last question?
Yeah, sure, sure.
Brilliant. Given your incredible story, what would you say is your proudest achievement, and maybe what is a regret that you have?
The proudest achievement for me was in negotiating under Tony Blair the Northern Ireland settlement of 2007 that brought, you know, those bitter blood enemies, Ian Paisley Sr. and Martin McGuinness, former IRA commander, to share government together. The next one is the stopping of the 1970 cricket tour, which people didn't think was possible, and we managed to do it. The third one, which, you know, we narrowly won the Welsh referendum, and I was one of the leaders of that campaign as a minister under the junior minister in the Welsh office appointed by Tony Blair to prior to devolution, to the part of the remit to win that campaign, and was very narrowly won. In retrospect, if you look at it, it was an extraordinary result, because only, you know, this is 1997. In 1979, Wales had voted 4-1 in a referendum against having a legislative assembly. So to win it narrowly is a massive swing of opinion. And I think what I did in that campaign, and most people objectively would agree, was pretty decisive. So amongst other things, those are the three that I would pick out, because, you know, each has had a decisive impact. But there are lots of other things I'm proud of. My one regret is standing for the deputy leadership of the Labour Party in 2007, having been pressed to do so by lots of people, including trade unionists, who then switched to support other people, which they're entitled to do. And, you know, some of the people closest to me urged me not to do it. And I didn't do well in the contest. I came second from bottom, and it was clear that I didn't have the support that I thought there might have been there 6 to 9 months before, when people who were urging me to stand. So I shouldn't have stood. And then, of course, the worst thing about it was there was a dysfunctional side to the campaign, and somehow, having reported in line with the regulations, a massive donations, tens of thousands of pounds of donations, somehow unaccountably, unknown to me, we didn't report another batch, and long over after the campaign had ended, and, you know, a lot of campaigns found themselves embroiled in these sorts of things, where no money was stolen, not a penny went into my pocket, but a massive undeclared donations meant that the Electoral Commission, for some bizarre reason, referred it to the police, and I had to stand down from the cabinet until my name was cleared that it was, because I hadn't done nothing wrong. And then I came back as a cabinet minister afterwards. So that's obviously, you know, was really upsetting. And in the end, I shouldn't have stood for the deputy leadership. And instead of negotiating the Northern Ireland peace settlement and getting legislation through the Secretary of State for Wales, which I was doing simultaneously to strengthen the devolution settlement, you know, I should have actually said, look, I don't really have time to wage this Deputy Leader campaign, and was saving me a lot of grief. But so that's my one regret.
It seems to be a consistent theme running through your life, really, getting accused of things that you really didn't do. So,
yeah, well, yeah, I don't know, maybe somebody's had it in for me, Joe, I don't know. But in the end, I'm still smiling and, you know, I'm proud of what part I've been able to play in both British politics and in change in South Africa. But, you know, other people have played much, much bigger roles. But I'm proud to have been able to do what I've done. And, you know, to the extent that I have a message for anybody else, it's just try to, I say this near the, in the Pretoria Boy, you know, in politics, you can quite easily get sort of self-centered and try to be somebody. I always say, don't try to be somebody, try to do something. That's my motto, and my associated motto is try to make a difference in whatever small way you can, or even if you get the chances, I've been privileged to be able to do so in a big way too. That would be my other kind of message. If you know somebody younger like you or others getting involved in politics, try to think of those things above all, and it'll do you good, but it'll also do the values that you believe in and the cause that you're fighting for good as well.
And there's that Mandela quote that you use, similar to that in Rhino Conspiracy, and you mentioned in the Pretoria Boy as well. I can't remember what it is, but it's something about how your impact on... I'm sure you remember it.
You know, it's in a nutshell, it's quoted there, so you can quote it accurately, but it's the point of being is not, you know, simply to be, it's to make a difference. It's to make a difference. And Mandela's got lots of memorable adages, but that's certainly, I think, for me, the most important one.
What counts in life is not the mere fact we have lived, it's the difference we have made to the lives of others.
Exactly. Spot on.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and thank you for speaking so candidly. I really thoroughly enjoyed reading both the books, and it's been great speaking to you.
Marvellous. Thanks, Joe. It's really enjoyable speaking to you as well, and good luck yourself and your personal future, but also good luck for what you're trying to achieve politically.
Cheers. Thank you, Peter.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.